So I see in the clockwise on my screen every one of you. So the first is Matteo, then me, then John, Robert, then Andrea, and Jeffrey. If you agree, you can take this sequence. So it's you, Matteo, your turn, Matteo.
And so we're in the introduction of the synthesis of yoga, the conditions of the synthesis, chapter 5, the synthesis of the systems. By the very nature of the principal yogic schools, each covering in its operations a part of the complex human integer, and attempting to bring out its highest possibilities, it will appear that a synthesis of all of them, largely conceived and applied, might well result in an integral yoga. But they are so disparate in their tendencies, so highly specialized and elaborated in their forms, so long confirmed in the mutual opposition of their ideas and methods, that we do not easily find how we can arrive at their right union.
An undiscriminating combination in block would not be a synthesis, but a confusion. Nor would a successive practice of each of them in turn be easy in the short span of our human life and with our limited energies, to say nothing of the waste of labor implied in so cumbrous a process. Sometimes, indeed, Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga are thus successfully practiced. And in a recent unique example in the life of Ramakrishna Paramahansa, we see a colossal spiritual capacity first driving straight to the divine realization, taking, as it were, the kingdom of heaven by violence, and then seizing upon one yogic method after another and extracting the substance out of it with an incredible rapidity, always to return to the heart of the whole matter, the realization and possession of God by the power of love, by the extension of inborn spirituality into various experience, and by the spontaneous play of an intuitive knowledge. Such an example cannot be generalized. Its object also was special and temporal, to exemplify in the great and decisive experience of a master soul the truths, now most necessary to humanity, towards which a world long divided into jarring sects and schools is with difficulty laboring, that all sects are forms and fragments of a single integral truth, and all disciplines labor in their different ways towards one supreme experience. To know, be, and possess the divine is the one thing needful, and it includes or leads up to all the rest. Towards this sole good we have to drive, and this attained, all the rest that the divine will chooses for us, all necessary form and manifestation will be added.
The synthesis we propose cannot then be arrived at either by combination in mass or by successive practice. It must therefore be affected by neglecting the forms and outsides of the yogic disciplines and seizing rather on some central principle common to all, which will include and utilize in the right place and proportion their particular principles, and on some central dynamic force, which is the common secret of their divergent methods and capable therefore of organizing a natural selection and combination of their varied energies and different utilities. This was the aim which we set before ourselves at first when we entered upon our comparative examination of the methods of nature and the methods of yoga. And we now return to it with the possibility of hazarding some definite solution.
We observe first that there still exists in India a remarkable yogic system, which is in its nature synthetical and starts from a great central principle of nature, a great dynamic force of nature, but it is a yoga apart, not a synthesis of other schools. This system is the way of the Tantra. Owing to certain of its developments, Tantra has fallen into discredit with those who are not tantrics. And especially owing to the developments of its left-hand path, the Vama Marga, which not content with exceeding the duality of virtue and sin, and instead of replacing them by spontaneous rightness of action, seemed to make a method of self-indulgence, a method of unrestrained social immorality. Nevertheless, in its origin, Tantra was a great and puissant system founded upon ideas which were at least partially true. Even its twofold division into the right-hand and left-hand paths, Dakshina Marga and Vama Marga, started from a certain profound perception. In the ancient symbolic sense of the words Dakshina and Vama, it was a distinction between the way of knowledge and the way of Ananda, nature in man liberating itself by right discrimination in power and practice of its own energies, elements and potentialities, and nature in man liberating itself by joyous acceptance in power and practice of its own energies, elements and potentialities. But in both paths, there was in the end an obscuration of principle, a deformation of symbols, and a fall.
If, however, we leave aside here also the actual methods and practices and seek for the central principle, we find first that Tantra expressly differentiates itself from the Vedic methods of yoga. In a sense, all the schools we have hitherto examined are Vedantic in their principle. Their force is in knowledge. Their method is knowledge, but is not always discernment by the intellect, but may be instead the knowledge of the heart expressed in love and faith, or a knowledge in the will working out through action. In all of them, the Lord of the yoga is the Purusha, the conscious soul that knows, observes, attracts, governs. But in Tantra, it is rather Prakriti, the nature soul, the energy, the will and power executive in the universe. It was by learning and applying the intimate secrets of this will and power, its method, its Tantra, that the Tantric yogin pursued the aims of his discipline: mastery, perfection, liberation, beatitude. Instead of drawing back from manifested nature and its difficulties, he confronted them, seized, and conquered. But in the end, as is the general tendency of Prakriti, Tantric yoga largely lost its principle in its machinery and became a thing of formulae and occult mechanism still powerful when rightly used, but fallen from the clarity of their original intention.
We have in this central tantric conception one side of the truth, the worship of the energy, the Shakti, as the sole effective force for all attainment. We get the other extreme in the Vedantic conception of the Shakti as a power of illusion, and in the search after the silent, inactive Purusha as the means of liberation from the deceptions created by the active energy. But in the integral conception, the conscious soul is the Lord. The nature soul is his executive energy. Purusha is of the nature of Sat, the being of conscious self-existence, pure and infinite. Shakti or Prakriti is of the nature of Chit. It is power of the Purusha's self-conscious existence, pure and infinite. The relation of the two exists between the poles of rest and action. When the energy is absorbed in the bliss of conscious self-existence, there is rest. When the Purusha pours itself out in the action of its energy, there is action, creation, and the enjoyment or ananda of becoming. But if ananda is the creator and begetter of all becoming, its method is tapas, or force of the Purusha's consciousness, dwelling upon its own infinite potentiality in existence and producing from it truths of conception or real ideas, vijnana, which, proceeding from an omniscient and omnipotent self-existence, have the surety of their own fulfillment and contain in themselves the nature and law of their own becoming in the terms of mind, life, and matter. The eventual omnipotence of tapas and the infallible fulfillment of the idea are the very foundation of all yoga. In man, we render these terms by will and faith. A will that is eventually self-effective because it is of the substance of knowledge, and a faith that is the reflex in the lower consciousness of a truth or real idea yet unrealized in the manifestation. It is this self-certainty of the idea which is meant by the Gita when it says, whatever is a man's faith or the sure idea in him, that he becomes. That's 17.3, if anyone wants a reference.
We see then what, from the psychological point of view, and yoga is nothing but practical psychology, is the conception of nature from which we have to start. It is the self-fulfillment of the Purusha through his energy. But the movement of nature is twofold, higher and lower, or as we may choose to term it, divine and undivine. The distinction exists indeed for practical purposes only, for there is nothing that is not divine. And in a larger view, it is a meaningless verbally as a distinction between natural and supernatural, for all things that are natural. All things are in nature and all things are in God. But for practical purposes, there is a real distinction. The lower nature, that which we know and are and must remain so long as the face in us is not changed, acts through limitation and division, is of the nature of ignorance and culminates in the life of the ego. But the higher nature, that to which we aspire, acts by unification and transcendence of limitation, is of the nature of knowledge and culminates in the life divine. The passage from the lower to the higher is the aim of yoga, and this passage may effect itself by the rejection of the lower and escape into the higher, the ordinary viewpoint, or by the transformation of the lower and in its elevation to the higher nature. It is this, rather, that must be the aim of an integral yoga.
But in either case, it is always through something in the lower that we must rise into the higher existence. In the schools of yoga, each select their own point of departure or their own gate of escape. They specialize certain activities of the lower prakriti and turn them toward the divine. But the normal action of nature in us is an integral movement in which the full complexity of all our elements is affected by and affects all our environments. The whole of life is the yoga of nature. The yoga that we seek must also be an integral action of nature. And the whole difference between the yogin and the natural man will be this, that the yogin seeks to substitute in himself for the integral action of the lower nature working in and by ego and division, working in and by ego and division, the integral action of the higher nature, working in and by God and unity. So I'm going to read that sentence again. The yoga that we seek also must be an integral action of nature, and the whole difference between the yogin and the natural man will be this, that the yogin seeks to substitute in himself for the integral action of the lower nature, working in and by ego and division, the integral action of the higher nature, working in and by God and unity. If indeed our aim be only an escape from the world to God, synthesis is unnecessary and a waste of time. For then our sole practical aim must be to find out one path out of the thousand that lead to God, one shortest possible of shortcuts, and not to linger exploring different paths that end in the same goal. But if our aim be a transformation of our integral being into the terms of God existence, it is then that a synthesis becomes necessary.
The method we have to pursue then is to put our whole conscious being into relation and contact with the divine, and to call him in to transform our entire being into his, so that in a sense God himself, the real person in us, becomes the sadhaka and the sadhana. And the sadhana is the practice by which perfection, siddhi, is attained. The sadhaka, the yogin, who seeks by that practice the siddhi. As well as the master of the yoga, by whom the lower personality is used as the center of a divine transfiguration and the instrument of its own perfection. In effect, the pressure of the tapas, the force of consciousness in us, dwelling in the idea of the divine nature upon that which we are in our entirety, produces its own realization. The divine and all-knowing and all-affecting descends upon the limited and obscure, progressively illumines and energizes the whole lower nature, and substitutes its own action for all the terms of the inferior human light and mortal activity.
In psychological fact, This method translates itself into the progressive surrender of the ego with its whole field and all its apparatus to the beyond ego with its vast and incalculable but always inevitable workings. Certainly, this is no shortcut or easy sadhana. It requires a colossal faith, an absolute courage, and above all, an unflinching patience. For it implies three stages, of which only the last can be wholly blissful or rapid. The attempt of the ego to enter into contact with the divine, the wide, full, and therefore laborious preparation of the whole lower nature by the divine working to receive and become the higher nature, and the eventual transformation. In fact, however, the divine strength, often unobserved and behind the veil, substitutes itself for our weakness and supports us through all our failings of faith, courage, and patience. It makes the blind to see and the lame to stride over the hills. The intellect becomes aware of a law that beneficially insists and a succor that upholds. The heart speaks of a master of all things and friend of man, or a universal mother who upholds through all stumblings. Therefore, this path is at once the most difficult imaginable, and yet, in comparison with the magnitude of its effort and object, the most easy and sure of all.
I think I'll break slightly just to ask, does anyone have anything that they want to share or anything? Just a quick pause. If not, I'll continue. All good.
Only that I really like this chapter.
Okay. There are three outstanding features of this action of the higher when it works integrally on the lower nature. In the first place, it does not act according to a fixed system and succession as in the specialized methods of yoga, but with a sort of free, scattered, and yet gradually intensive and purposeful working determined by the temperament of the individual in whom it operates, the helpful materials which his nature offers, and the obstacles which it presents to purification and perfection. In a sense, therefore, each man in his path has his own method of yoga. Yet, are there certain broad lines of working common to all which enable us to construct, not indeed a routine system, but yet some kind of shastra or scientific method of the synthetic yoga?
Secondly, the process, being integral, accepts our nature such as it stands, organized by our past evolution, and without rejecting anything essential, compels all to undergo a divine change. Sorry, I reread this sentence. Secondly, the process, being integral, accepts our nature such as it stands, organized by our past evolution, and without rejecting anything essential, compels all to undergo a divine change. Everything in us is seized by the hands of a mighty artificer and transformed into a clear image of that which it now seeks confusedly to present. In that ever progressive experience, we begin to perceive how this lower manifestation is constituted, and that everything in it, however seemingly deformed or petty or vile, is the more or less distorted or imperfect figure of some element or action in the harmony of the divine nature. we begin to understand what the Vedic rishis meant when they spoke of the human forefathers fashioning the gods as the smith forges the crude material in his smithy.
Thirdly, the divine power in us uses all life as the means of this integral yoga. Every experience and outer contact with our world environment, however trifling or however disastrous, is used for the work. And every inner experience, even to the most repellent suffering or the most humiliating fall, becomes a step on the path to perfection. And we recognize in ourselves with opened eyes the method of God in the world, his purpose of light in the obscure, of might in the weak and fallen, of delight in what is grievous and miserable. We see the divine method to be the same in the lower and in the higher working. Only in the one it is pursued tardily and obscurely through the subconscious in nature. In the other, it becomes swift and self-conscious, and the instrument confesses the hand of the master. All life is a yoga of nature seeking to manifest God within itself. Yoga marks the stage at which this effort becomes capable of self-awareness and therefore of right completion in the individual. It is a gathering up and concentration of the movements dispersed and loosely combined in the lower evolution.
An integral method and an integral result. First, an integral realization of divine being. Not only a realization of the one in its indistinguishable unity, but also in its multitude of aspects which are also necessary to the complete knowledge of it by the relative consciousness. Not only realization of unity in the self, but of unity in the infinite diversity of activities, worlds, and creatures.
Therefore, also an integral liberation. Not only the freedom born of unbroken contact and identification of the individual being in all its parts with the divine, by which it can become free even in its separation, even in the duality. Not only the Salakya Mukti, by which the whole conscious existence dwells in the same status of being as the divine, in the state of Sachidananda, but also the acquisition of the divine nature by the transformation of this lower being into the human image of the divine, Sadharmya Mukti, and the complete and final release of all, the liberation of the consciousness from the transitory mold of the ego, and its unification with the one being, universal both in the world and the individual, and transcendentally one both in the world and beyond all universe.
Sorry, I forgot it was my turn. By the integral realization and liberation, the perfect harmony of the results of knowledge, love, and works. By this integral realization and liberation, the perfect harmony of the results of knowledge, love, and works. Is that a complete sentence?
We had this discussion before, Matthew. Okay.
It still doesn't sound right.
Each of these paragraphs that we've been reading starts off with a phrase that kind of gives the subject of the paragraph.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Therefore, also an integral liberation. Thank you. Yeah. For there is attained By this integral realization and liberation, the perfect harmony of the results of knowledge, love, and works. For there is attained the complete release from ego and identification in being with the one in all and beyond all. But since the attaining consciousness is not limited by its attainment, we win also the unity in beatitude and the harmonized diversity of love, so that all relations of the play remain possible to us, even while we retain on the heights of our being the eternal oneness with the beloved. And by a similar wideness, being capable of a freedom and spirit that embraces life and does not depend upon withdrawal from life, we are able to become, without egoism, bondage, or reaction, the channel in our mind and body for a divine action poured out freely upon the world.
The divine existence is of the nature not only of freedom, but of purity, beatitude, and perfection. An integral purity which shall enable, on the one hand, the perfect reflection of the divine being in ourselves, and on the other hand, the perfect outpouring of its truth and law in us, in the terms of life and through the right functioning of the complex instrument we are in our outer parts, is the condition of an integral liberty. I read this sentence again. An integral purity which shall enable, on the one hand, the perfect reflection of the divine being in ourselves, and on the other, the perfect outpouring of its truth and law in us in the terms of life and through the right functioning of the complex instruments we are in outer parts, is the condition of an integral liberty. Its result is an integral beatitude, in which there becomes possible at once the ananda of all that is in the world, seen as symbols of the divine, and the ananda of that which is not world. And it prepares the integral perfection of our humanity as a type of the divine in the conditions of the human manifestation, a perfection founded on a certain free universality of being, of love and joy, of play of knowledge, and of play of will in power and will in unegoistic action. This integrality also can be attained by the integral yoga.
Perfection includes perfection of mind and body, so that the highest results of Raja Yoga and Hatha Yoga should be contained in the widest formula of the synthesis finally to be effected by mankind. At any rate, a full development of the general mental and physical faculties and experiences attained by humanity through yoga must be included in the scope of the integral method. Nor would these have any raison d'etre unless employed for an integral mental and physical life. Such a mental and physical life would be in its nature a translation of the spiritual existence into its right mental and physical values. Thus, we would arrive at a synthesis of the three degrees of nature and of the three modes of human existence which she has evolved or is evolving. We would include in the scope of our liberated being and perfected modes of activity the material life, our base, and the mental life, our intermediate instrument.
Nor would the integrality to which we aspire be real or even possible if it were confined to the individual. Since our divine perfection embraces the realization of ourselves in being, in life, and in love through others as well as through ourselves, the extension of our liberty and of its results in others would be the inevitable outcome, as well as the broadest utility of our liberation and perfection. And the constant and inherent attempt of such an extension would be towards its increasing and ultimately complete generalization in mankind.
The divinizing of the normal material life of man and of his great secular attempt of mental and moral self-culture in the individual and the race by this integralization of a widely perfect spiritual existence would thus be the crown alike of our individual and our common effort. Such a consummation, being no other than the kingdom of heaven within, reproduced in the kingdom of heaven without, would be also the true fulfillment of the great dream cherished in different terms by the world's religions. The widest synthesis of perfection possible to thought is the sole effort entirely worthy of those whose dedicated vision perceives that God dwells concealed in humanity.
A wonderful chapter, I think.
It is nice to read it straight through.
I don't know if you had the same experience, but in the last weeks where we read this chapter, always some question came to my mind that I didn't find the answer. And now I'm reading and I find the answer to the question that I had. So it's a sort of synchronicity that sometimes I experience when reading the things of Sri Aurobindo.
With prose like this and essays like this, we might want to consider reading it straight through, then doing more of a dissection, then reading it straight through again, because some of those things maybe don't get resolved when we do a dissection right away. Maybe, I don't know. There's so much to learn and so much depth to plunge into. Maybe our approach doesn't matter.
Sorry, but I didn't understand. I'm not sure to understand what you're making a proposal, Matteo, to do.
I don't know if it's as official as a proposal. It's a thought based on what you just said.
Okay. I'm sorry, Andrea. Go ahead.
It's okay. So what struck me here, and I don't recall that this has appeared before, that the others all of a sudden are in the picture. The realization of ourselves in being, in life, and in love through others as well as through ourselves. And I don't recall there having been any conversation before this of bringing others into the picture. I mean, there's of course humanity as a totality, but the whole thing seemed to have been focused on individual, you know, work of liberation. And here all of a sudden this is beautiful, bringing it together with each other. I mean, we are doing this together after all. But that, am I right? Is this like the first place where this comes in? I don't recall having read it before.
Yeah, I certainly have, but I don't know what is meant by first time or first place that it's come in.
Just in these beginning chapters.
In that case, if we're looking at synthesis of yoga, maybe you're right, but yeah, I don't know for sure. It certainly exists in the initial chapters of Life Divine, and taking these similar, these are all serial works in the Arya, there is a development goes on, and it's really dovetailed with that theme of, you know, we can have spiritual, we can possess God if we just go straight there alone, but that's not an integral realization unless it's done in the world. And there's no in the world without others. So it might be, I've always seen that implication there, but yeah, I love the direct mention too.
Yeah.
My memory is it came into different passages that we've already read in this book, but I'd have to go through and look at the chapters in detail to pick it up again. Yeah. The other thing about your
question, keen into something beautiful, Andrea. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing, Matthew, about your thing, I do feel that so reading it straight through, it's what I can do on my own. I'm not sure what I get from the group from that. The discussion of the paragraphs is something I can only do in the group. And then the reading through after having done that discussion has its sense. So I'm not against it. You know, I think it could be interesting. I'm just not sure that it has the same value as the other parts.
I hear you, Jeffrey. I don't think that there's a wrong approach. I really don't. There's some mutual friends that we have that are like, this is the way to read Savitri. And I'm like, poppycock. there's actually no way to any approach is an approach worth making. So yeah, I don't know. It's just an idea that I was riffing off of Marco's. I hear you, Jeffrey. I'm super open to how, I love how we're approaching it and our work together.
So I'm kind of wondering, since Jeffrey, you have to leave early, how early?
Yeah,
early?
I was going to say I should probably get going, actually. It would be useful if I did. Could we do a meditation?
And I have a mountain of work that's nagging at me, too. Maybe if the group is okay with it, we wrap up early today. Yeah, I don't know, but I don't want to. If there's an impulse to go on, I don't want to disrupt that by saying that at all. I just could go either way. I've got so my do list is massive right now.
Yeah, we have also.
I do have an impulse to go on, but if everybody else, you know, has other things to do, I'm just going to go on my own for, you know, until 1:30 or this last half hour, because I'm really enjoying this.
Yeah, I feel kind of similar that's confusing. I feel complete. I'm reading through one whole chapter in one run is quite a stretch for my mind. And since we started late, I would be happy to stop here for myself.
It's okay. I'm neutral, so I would say the majority opts for leaving today. But it's okay because we have also gone through part zero. Next time we will begin with part one. And so it's the conclusion of the part, or the preface of the first part. So it wraps up also mentally, the mind, you know, wants to have everything in its chapters, so also the mind is satisfied, maybe.
Following along on the mind, so we've gone through part zero, that means we haven't done anything yet, so next time we'll start on the first part.
Don Robert, I'm counting on you to perfect some of these cities in the four aids for all of us while we sign off. And
no problem, Mateo.
It's up to you, John Robert, to at least perfect the Shastra and perfect the personal effort for us.
Piece of cake.
Okay, we'll have a little meditation then.
Okay.
I'm so glad we were able to get together. Thank you for all the collective effort.
Thank you all. This was good for me on a busy day.
Me too.
Okay.
Bye, everyone.
Namaste, bye. Everyone.
Bye, friends. See you all soon.